This is Holiday Readings and Remembrances, reflections on the season as told by members of the Northern Michigan University and surrounding communities. I'm Stan Wright. Today we hear from author and Northern Michigan University professor of English, John Smolens.
Nobody wants to work Christmas Eve, but in 1974, I had no choice. I'd recently driven my VW van from Boston's North Shore to the West Coast because I was in my early 20s and I'd never done it before. I arrived in San Francisco with very little money, and the first job I could find was working in the kitchen at a place called the Pink Pelican. My title was sous chef, but since it was a two-man kitchen the size of a postage stamp, this meant that along with all the prep work, I was also responsible for scrubbing pots, washing the dishes, and making sure each long-stem wine glass was spotless. When you entered the Pink Pelican from the sidewalk, there was a long bar to your right with booths and a jukebox along the left-hand wall. In the back, there was seating for 24 diners, six tables of four. The decor was what might be called 1970s Sugar Daddy Deluxe. The dominant colors were pink and purple, and the walls were giant mirrors making the place seem larger and more crowded than it actually was. And all this glass proved to be a problem for certain patrons who, while staggering toward the restroom, would bump into someone suspiciously familiar. Eight men owned the Pink Pelican. Seven of them had names like Polly, Gino, and Vinny, and then there was one Lester. They owned strip joints in the city's North Beach district, and this little restaurant was meant to be a playpen for their pals. Every night, Cadillacs and Lincoln Continentals pulled up to the curb and disgorged middle-aged guys with gargantuan sideburns, accompanied by gorgeous women young enough to be their daughters. Drinks were heavy, there was a good wine cellar, and the menu tended towards steaks, seafood, and pasta. This was the kind of place where it wasn't uncommon to find several San Francisco 49er football players seated at the bar, and occasionally a waitress would burst into the kitchen saying that some big name was at table three. In those days, Boz Scaggs was a big name. Usually by midnight, the tenor of the place had been elevated to near hysteria, which often spilled over into the kitchen, a comparatively tranquil place where certain kinds of business could be conducted in privacy. One owner, Joey, had his arm in a cast, claiming that he'd taken a fall in an open manhole cover in Golden Gate Park, for which he was going to sue the city of San Francisco, the state of California, and perhaps even the United States. But in the meantime, he used his sling to carry wads of unmarked bills, vials of illicit drugs, and, on several occasions, what he referred to as his friend. On Christmas Eve, Joey came into the kitchen, reached into his sling, and removed his snub-nosed revolver. "Here," he said, handing the gun to me. "Hang on to this till I come back. Stick it, you know, someplace where it don't get too wet." I put the revolver on a shelf under the dishwasher, behind the plastic bin full of soap detergent. "Yeah, that's good," Joey said as he pushed open the swinging door. Between the steam from the dishwasher and meat cooking on the grill, the kitchen was always hot and smoky. I looked over at Leon, who was putting plates of pasta up on the counter. Leon did impressions. He did Richard Nixon, JFK, Jose Jimenez, and Ed Sullivan, to name a few. And he did a remarkably good Dolly Parton. He looked at me over the top of his glasses, which meant he was about to do Lyndon Johnson, and drawled, "At this point in our nation's history, I would advise all Americans to wipe their fingerprints off of any firearm in their possession." As I wiped down the revolver, the waitress came in to collect the dinners for table four. Mindy worked at the Pink Pelican on nights off from dancing in the strip joints in North Beach. Nothing fazed her, and as she balanced plates on her forearms, she looked at the gun in my hand and said, "Christmas present?" It being Christmas Eve, it was a slow night. Ordinarily, the hours flew by in a blur. The kitchen often felt like a ship at sea that had struck an iceberg and was taking on water. The simplest order, say, a tossed salad with balsamic vinegar and olive oil, or zuppa di cozze, was a matter of survival. It seemed we were constantly extinguishing fires. Leon and I did a kind of ballet together in that little kitchen, passing food and plates back and forth and dashing in and out of the walk-in refrigerator. We survived each night on vast rushes of adrenaline, dexterity, and cooking wine. Orders were shouted, and the timing on the steaks could be as breathtaking as a Kentucky Derby photo finish. Today, I'm convinced the world is going to ruin because everybody wants to be a chef. All you have to do is don a white tunic and one of those tall hats that make you look like a conehead in a red state, and voila, you're Shea Bill. Six-figure executives ditch corporate careers to enroll in cooking academies, or they pack off to Europe where they slave away under a dictatorial Tuscan butcher or find bliss in a Viennese pastry shop. Everybody blanks out on the cooking channel, and nothing sells like a cookbook. But for Leon and me, the kitchen was a prison, a place to one day escape. We didn't want to be cooks. We wanted to be diners. But in the meantime, honey, Leon would say in his best Dolly Parton, we just got to feed these bozos. Along toward midnight, an extraordinary thing happened. One of the owners, Gino, came into the kitchen and said, the place is empty, boys. We've closed early, so come on out to the bar for your Christmas bonus. So we abandoned the kitchen and sat at the bar with the other owners. A string of blue Christmas lights winked on and off above the bar, and the jukebox played three songs over and over. Tony Bennett's I Left My Heart in San Francisco, of course. Nat King Cole's Chestnuts Roasting on an Open Fire, of course. And the most popular song of that year, Maria Muldaur's Midnight at the Oasis. We all sat at the bar, wise guys, cooks, and Mindy, who was wearing a tight red sequin dress and reindeer antlers on her platinum blonde hair. Our Christmas bonus was anything we wanted from the bar, so Leon and I asked for a fine single malt scotch from the top shelf. Finally, Gino looked at all of us lined up at the bar and said, what a pathetic bunch. It's Christmas for cry eye. I'm going down to the wine cellar and pick out a nice Merlot to celebrate. That'll cheer you bums up. Nobody disagreed. This in itself was extraordinary because hardly a night passed when there wasn't some flare-up between the owners and often between the patrons and the owners. Their arguments always came down to two things, money and women. But that night, in the first hour of Christmas, everyone sat at the bar and behaved as though we were family, even Joey, who could be one belligerent guy. But after a few minutes, Gino came back upstairs, saying things that cannot be repeated on National Public Radio. There a problem, Gino? Lester asked. Gino went behind the bar, where he could look at all of us as though we were in a lineup down at the local precinct. Somebody stole the wine, he said. What, all of it? No, just the good stuff, Gino said. Maybe a dozen bottles, easily worth a few grand. Someone whistled. It's got to be someone here at this bar, Gino added, because nobody else can get in there. Nobody else knows about the key. This was true. We all knew the key to the wine cellar, which was just a small storeroom, was hidden in a crevice in the rock foundation of the basement. When I was first hired, I had been shown where the key was and given explicit orders to never tell anyone about it. Everybody started talking at once, and soon guys were shouting, which was how trouble usually started. Leon nudged my ribs and nodded toward the kitchen, where we saw Joey disappear through the swinging door. And then Leon looked at me, and I knew exactly what he was thinking. These guys will fight over money, over women, but by the end of the night, they'll have another drink, kiss, and make up. You could get away with most anything at the Pink Pelican. You could steal a guy's girl or even his car, but you do not steal the wine. Gino came down to our end of the bar and folded his arms. He stared at Leon until Leon said, "Don't look at me, boss." Gino turned his attention on me and said, "I think it's this idiot." He was right. I was an idiot. I had sore cuticles from deveining prawns all afternoon, and my tunic was smeared with tomato sauce and the blood of four-legged animals. I was a couple of years out of college, but I was washing dishes in a joint like this. "You take my wine, kid?" Gino asked. Before I could answer, Joey came out of the kitchen. His suit was dusted with white powder, and in his good hand he held his friend, which was also covered with soap detergent. Someone chuckled, but not for long. Joey went behind the bar, and with a towel he proceeded to wipe off the revolver, which he then carefully laid on the mahogany bar in front of my glass. "So," he said to me, "you're the bright guy who put my friend under the dishwasher so I could drop it in that bucket of soap, and you ruined my nice suit. You asked me to hide it, remember?" I said. And looking at Gino, I added, "I didn't take your wine." Gino and Joey both stared at me for a long time. Clearly, they didn't like what they saw. From down the bar, one of the other guys, I think it was Polly, said, "Lay off the kid. He wouldn't know what to do with wine like that." This actually was true. I wasn't going to drink it because it would be years before I would develop a taste for wine, and I didn't know anybody who would have enough money to buy it. So why would I take such a risk? Gino and Joey continued to stare at me, and it seemed that slowly they were coming to a similar conclusion, until Gino said, "Yeah, he might be an idiot, but he's not stupid." Then Gino walked down the bar and picked up the bottle of scotch, while Joey remained in front of me, looking extremely perturbed. It was at that moment that I realized that Joey was the one everybody was very careful with. There was just no knowing what Joey could do. When he picked up his friend, my blood froze, but he simply tucked it away inside his sling and turned to Gino, who handed him a tumbler of scotch. "Well, everybody," Joey said, raising his glass, which was smudged with white fingerprints, "wine or no wine, salute, and Merry Christmas." After a moment, every glass was raised, and we all said, "Merry Christmas." There wasn't going to be a fight. No one was going to get shot. Not tonight. Leon sang along to Chestnuts Roasting on an Open Fire, creating a lovely duet between Nat King Cole and Jose Jimenez. Mindy came down the bar giving each of us a hug and a kiss on the cheek. And when she reached me, she was trembling, and the tears in her eyes were ruining her mascara. I only worked at the Pink Pelican another few weeks, and I left San Francisco in the spring. At that age, picking up and driving across the country in 4 days was not a problem. Several times during the following year, I would call Leon, who had begun taking classes at Berkeley in Chinese history. He said that the Pink Pelican had closed not long after I left. One day he got there and the doors were locked and nobody showed up. Over the next week, there were stories in the San Francisco newspapers about all the owners who had been charged with money laundering, racketeering, and drug trafficking. Eventually, they all did time. Once I asked Leon about the Christmas wine, if they ever found out who stole it, and he said, doing his best Richard Nixon, "I don't know, and I'm here to tell you that I am not a criminal."
Holiday Readings and Remembrances is a Public Radio 90 production produced at the WNMU-FM studios in the Learning Resources Center on the campus of Northern Michigan University. I'm your producer and host, Stan Wright. Thanks for listening, and happy holidays.